Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here, along with Shad Marquitz. We're your hosts for this weekend's edition. As I say on every weekend show, please be sure to go back through our website, kereport.com, and podcast, The KE Report, to listen to all our daily editorials and company updates. We try to keep everybody as up to speed as we can with a wide range of guests and a wide range of companies to, well, make sense of these market moves. Now, this week was a bit more of a quiet week for the markets after some pretty crazy moves in the last couple weeks, more to the upside. So it's been a bit more encouraging for investors in a lot of different sectors outside of the dollar, which has been moving pretty aggressively down. But the big question being, where do markets go from here? Is this nothing more than a dead cat bounce? Is this going to just be setting up for another pop higher? We'll be talking a lot about that on this weekend show. We're kicking off this show with Jesse Felder, founder and editor of the Felder Report. Jesse, let's start with that initial comment there. Is this nothing more than a dead cat bounce for the markets? Or do you think that there is actually a bit of a change in sentiment out here? And clearly investors are willing to put a bit more money at play, but is that sustainable?
It's a great question. And I think, you know, there are a number of indicators that I follow very closely that would, you know, help to kind of answer this question. I think there are certain things you look for to determine a sustainable low and, you know, the higher probability of a sustainable rally, new bull market. And we're not seeing any of those things appear in the markets yet. We haven't seen a good oversold condition. We haven't seen any sort of trend signals that point to a longer term bottoming condition in the market. I'm kind of looking at the Copic curve here, which is basically just a longer term trend following indicator. You'd also look at a lot of macro signals like leading indicators for earnings and these kinds of things. None of these things are pointing to a sustainable bottom for stocks at this time. You know, another one would be, cyclically sensitive sectors within the stock market. You'd want to see them leading to the upside. They're not doing that. And so that's kind of another failed signal. We've had some, you know, failed breadth thrusts. We haven't seen the type of breadth to the upside that would be indicative of a stronger upside move. So the longer term signals are still very bearish. But at the same time, I wrote a chart book about 2 weeks ago titled Traders Are Short Everything Under the Sun, and basically just pointing out that the net short positions in stocks, in bonds, in precious metals, basically, you know, traders in futures for a lot of these things and in options markets and in whatever market you kind of want to look at had gotten far, far too bearish, and the short side had gotten far too crowded. So with momentum waning to the downside and a very crowded short side, it didn't take much in the way of positive news to create a short squeeze. And I think that's exactly what we're seeing right now.
Yeah, Jesse, it's interesting because if we dial it back just to the end of 2021, everybody was so exuberant about the markets that there was hardly anybody hedging their positions and there was very few short positions. Then the markets correct about 20-30%. And everybody gets hedged, everybody gets short, everybody gets negative. And that's exactly when you see a rally like this. But you had put out a piece recently just talking about what David Einhorn had mentioned. And he said, I don't know if value investing ever comes back. Most of the value investors have been put out of business. Nobody knows what anything is worth anymore. Is it also a situation where the valuations we've seen for a dozen years were so divorced from anything that was value that people don't know what things should be worth anymore? And so they're just buying the dip like they always have.
I think that's a good point. We see one of the things that I watch pretty closely is the Goldman Sachs non-profitable tech index. And essentially it tracks a basket of stocks that are, you know, overlap a great deal with things that you'd find in the ARK Innovation Fund. And there's still a lot of money. I look at the flows into the leveraged ARK ETF. So you can, you know, there's a leveraged upside ARK ETF, a leveraged downside ARK ETF, and there's still tons of money that's flowing into ARK itself, but then also into the leveraged upside ETF too. And that just tells me that there are a lot of investors out there who probably have never been through a bear market before. And they're thinking that because these stocks have come down 70, 80, 90% in the last 10, 11 months, that they have to be good value. And if you look back to the last time we had a bubble in these types of stocks back in the late 90s, most of them go out of business, especially non-profitable ones, and especially when their cost of capital is being raised as dramatically as it is today. So the downside, potential downside still in front of them is really great. And, you know, I think that the fact that the buy the dip mentality in these stocks is still alive and well is a very clear sign that the longer term sentiment in the market hasn't yet become bearish enough to indicate that we're near a bear market low, a sustainable, important low. You know, a lot of people this year have been looking for quote unquote capitulation in the markets. And I think those are the types of things that they're looking for, signs that investors have given up on the upside. And that just hasn't appeared yet.
Jesse, we have clearly seen this rotation trade, though. And a lot can be, I think, blamed on simply higher rates, because there is an alternative for investors to put their money into some sort of money market funds and actually generate a yield. So they're not chasing really any high-flying stocks right now. They seem to be looking more for these stocks that actually have a business, that actually generate revenue and profits. What have you noticed in terms of this ongoing now, which is over a year, rotation trade?
Well, it's amazing to me, because when you look at flows, right? Money has flowed into equities this year, equity ETFs, and it's flowed into fixed income ETFs this year. And we've had net outflows from commodities. And I mean, it's exactly the opposite of what you would expect based on the performance, right? I mean, it's astounding to me that it looks like maybe investors are embracing energy. Maybe investors are embracing commodities. Maybe investors are embracing these inflations, but it's the exact same. You know, you look at the B of A flows indicators and these kinds of things, and investors are offloading precious metals, offloading tips, offloading commodities, and they're still buying growth. They're buying stocks. They're buying growth and value stocks. They're buying, you know, and so, you know, there just hasn't been a real shift yet. You know, so I think the people who think that are arguing that the commodities boom is over are way off base. I couldn't be further off base. Investors haven't even begun to embrace this trade yet. So it still has a long, long way to go. And the rotation trade, I think from growth to value and from more asset light types of things to more real assets, that trade is still in the very, very early innings.
Well, let's dig into that concept a little bit more, Jesse, because in light of what we've seen in the cryptoverse just over the last week or so, things that are not necessarily as tangible or real, do you think we'll see some of those capital flows from maybe people that get a little jaded at that space go into things like hard assets? And do you think that, I guess, the energy crisis that we've seen over the last year or so will also maybe tip off some more investors that have ignored things like oil and nat gas or uranium or lithium or nickel or copper? Will that bring more interest into hard assets, into real raw commodities?
Well, if there's any lesson from what's going on in crypto, it's that flows follow performance eventually, right? I mean, the BIS just put out a paper showing that that's exactly what's happened in crypto. When crypto has a terrific run, let's say Bitcoin prices surge over a two-year period, everybody gets in at the end of those two years. That's what we've seen. And like, it's 80 or 90% of the investors in Bitcoin right now are underwater. And that's just because they got in, you know, when Tom Brady was putting laser eyes on his Twitter account and the price was $65,000. And now it's $16,000. People are starting to abandon it. I think, you know, with the performance of commodities and things, investors will have to turn their attention to these things that are not only going to protect them from inflation if inflation remains elevated for a period of time, but also are dramatically undervalued at current prices. I think the only other thing, point that I would make is that people think that when there's an asset bust, that money flows out of that into something else. And that's just not the case. That money, when a bubble bursts, that money just evaporates. So it doesn't go anywhere else. It's just gone. And that's what happened in the dot-com bubble is, you know, when the NASDAQ went down 90% and all those stocks went out of business. I mean, only a handful of them, you know, survived and are still successful today. All the money that was lost, you know, people didn't sell and put that money into other things. They held them all the way down and until they went out of business and all that money was lost. That's kind of what we're seeing in crypto. I think a lot of people, there's tons of stories of and even in the meme stock thing, you know, with GameStop and a lot of the other AMC, you know, there's story after story after story of people who started with $5,000 or $10,000, made $1 million and gave it all back, lost it all. And that's what happens during these busts is the money doesn't necessarily flow somewhere else. But I do think institutional investors who aren't super heavily exposed to these things are going to have to start looking at them because they are doing so well and they're still very cheap.
Jesse, do you think one of the issues with commodities and why we haven't seen a huge flow of money into them is because they have been around for so long and what seems to be the ones that truly run higher and really get greed in investors' minds are some of these newer sectors that when they get money coming in, boy, oh boy, it more seems like sky's the limit because, quite frankly, they don't have a long-term chart that shows everybody where it might top out at.
Well, I think, you know, these things go in cycles that are you know, you look at, I mean, there's a couple of famous charts that show the sentiment cycle. And you go from, you know, let's say with a bursting asset bubble, you get, you know, you first get denial and then you get panic and then you get despondency. And that's when things, you know, bottom out is in that time of despondency. People completely give up on them. And that's where we were in commodities in 2020. I mean, oil price went negative. People thought, you know, commodities have performed so poorly for so long and inflation's never coming back. Commodities are a useless asset class. They make no sense. And, you know, that's the despondency you get at the bottom. But then when, you know, things start turning up, you know, you get investors doubting, you know, that they're going to continue. But we're a long way from the topping of a market where everybody has embraced the trade and everybody believes it's going to continue forever. But that's what the top of a market looks like. And we're not even close to that in oil prices, precious metals, any of these other things, because investors still have a great deal of, you know, doubt over whether the trend is going to continue, whether there are good things to own over, you know, a 3 to 5 year period, let alone, you know, a permanent portfolio allocation. So I think that, you know, whether it's, you know, brand new asset class, like people, you know, have thought of cryptocurrencies, or whether it's commodities, which have been around forever, you know, probably one of the oldest asset classes that there is, they're also subject to the same sentiment cycle, you know, over long periods of time. And, you know, we're still in the very early stages of this, the sentiment cycle towards commodities. But this next phase of the bull market is going to be the time when investors really start to put their doubts aside and say, oh, my God, we have to own these things where everybody is dramatically underexposed to them. And they're going to have to rectify that because the next 10 years is going to be so different in the economy, in the markets, et cetera, than the last 10.
Well, Jesse, where do you anticipate institutional money, pension funds, insurance companies are going to go to find the safe havens, because we've seen the bond markets kind of implode over the last 2 years and the bond bubble of 40 years has burst. It's a different ballgame now. They were flowing into the dollar, but we've seen the dollar reverse course from 114.70 down to the mid 106s this week. And we had an article that came out and said gold is no longer a safe haven on a frontline headline from a major publication, which is usually a contrarian indicator. Do you think some of these large institutions and funds are going to start putting a percentage of their capital into hard assets as a safe haven?
Absolutely. And the problem is that the supply of investable assets is a tiny fraction. So if even, you know, a handful of institutions decide they need to up their exposure, it's going to have dramatic impacts on prices of these things. You know, you have to look back to the 70s to see the last time there was any institutional interest in these things. You know, when you look back, you see just parabolic, explosive moves higher in a lot of these commodities. And that's what institutional interest does to them. It's interesting. I was talking to a corporate plan, you know, 3-4 years ago, and their entire plan was, you know, they had a 60-40 portfolio. This is the retirement plan for this company. And, you know, just a few different permutations of that. They had no options for investing in any type of real assets, you know, not even TIPS or real estate investment trusts, let alone, you know, precious metals and commodities. And I said, you know, do you guys have an ability to add these types of things so that investors, you know, your employees can invest in them? I said, absolutely not. We don't think those are investable assets. And so, you know, stocks and bonds are your only option. That's the kind of mindset that I think a lot of, you know, pension funds and things have, is that these asset classes are not worthy of consideration. And that shift is going to be what characterizes the next stage of the bull market for these things.
So, Jesse, if we look back on history, what does this time feel like to you? What does it look like on the charts? What can we relate this back to? Because this is really a historic time where interest rates have skyrocketed higher, the Fed has been much tighter, inflation has stayed higher, and the markets have corrected, but they haven't crashed.
Yeah, you know, I have to defer to Stan Druckenmiller. You know, he's seen a lot more of this than I have, and he's obviously 10 times more brilliant than I could ever hope to be. And, you know, he's given several interviews lately. I think he's kind of come out of hiding a little bit because he feels like he needs to warn people about the situation. And you know, he's said the current setup is unlike anything he's ever seen in his career. That means we have to have a great deal of humility about what's going to happen going forward, because we really don't have any kind of analogs in terms of what's going on with the economy and what's going on with fiscal and monetary policy. It's unlike anything we've seen before to have inflation like this at the same time debt to GDP is at 120%, which really ties the Fed's hands. And that, you know, debt level is only going to go higher, especially now with, you know, interest rates going up and all these things. And so it's a very fraught situation. And I think, you know, that argues for having, like I said, a great deal of humility, not overcommitting to any one asset class, using diversification, and not ruling out, you know, the possibility of things like a crack up boom in markets where investors really decide, okay, inflation's not going to go away. How do I protect myself? Well, then I need to go, cash under the mattress is the worst of all options. I need to go buy things and commit capital to where things that are going to protect me, because the Fed is not going to be able to bring inflation back down or what have you. And so there's a lot of potentials out there. I think the tails right now are really fat, you know, in terms of statistics. And that means, you know, we have to be really, really careful and not bet on things going back to normal anytime soon.
Well, Jesse, I think that's a fantastic point, that there is no expectations of a returning to normal or things even going back to where they were even a couple of years ago. But you had put out a piece recently called The History of Asset Bubbles. And you get into a lot of different data in there. Some of it's about how ad revenue is trending. Some of it's about previous historical bubbles and what happened. And it seems like we're kind of at the end of a major asset bubble. Maybe there is that final crack up boom. But would you walk us through some of that data and just how you're looking at this asset bubble as it starts to deflate?
Well, the first thing I'd point out is a crack up boom is probably not, you know, the blow off top in markets that people would expect. I think a crack up boom would be a sign that inflation is becoming hyperinflation, and that, you know, and that's probably the worst possible situation we can imagine. I don't think it's the most likely by any stretch of the imagination. But if for some reason the Fed is unable to bring inflation back, and fiscal authorities are unwilling to cut spending and do other things, you know, necessary, then inflation is, you know, on a trajectory that could cause real havoc. And I think, you know, that, you know, owning, everybody needs to own some gold in the portfolio for that reason. The history of asset bubbles is that, you know, you get a bubble and it bursts and it creates a deflationary bust. I mean, that's kind of the template from, you know, Japan after 1990 to the dot-com bust. And, you know, it's why Ben Bernanke started printing so much money, because he was so afraid of a replay of the 1929 crash and the Great Depression. But because we haven't allowed that, you know, kind of normal bust to play out after the financial crisis, or, you know, anytime in the last, since the dot-com mania, I mean, Greenspan didn't let it play out because he was afraid of the same thing, that we've opened the door to the opposite, which is this inflationary situation that we're now facing. And if the Fed continues to make that choice of inflation rather than an asset price bust, then the writing is on the wall that, you know, like Paul Singer, you know, famous, super successful hedge fund managers point out, we're on the path to hyperinflation. I'm not trying to be, you know, hyperbolic or anything here. Like I said, I don't think that is the highest probability, but I think it's something we can't really discount. And I would say that I think markets are pricing in a return to normal. Markets are, it's you look at any of these inflation metrics, break evens and things, and investors are betting we're going back to normal in the next 12 to 24 months. Inflation's going to come back down and the Fed's going to be able to lower interest rates again. And if things don't go back to normal, it's going to create some shockwaves through the markets.
So, Jesse, are we just waiting for a big capitulation move? It seems like these dead cat bounces, they aren't believed, but investors are still wanting to be long. Maybe that's just their mentality forever, and maybe that will help support these markets. But how likely, in your eyes, is a major move down, a washout move?
Well, you know, we've talked a little bit about kind of the differences in the markets and what's worked in the last 10 years I don't think is going to work in the next 10. And that's really the problem with owning the S&P 500 today, is that it's, because it's market cap weighted and because these things have done so well, it's still super heavily weighted to these segments of the stock market, sectors that benefit from disinflation, namely, you know, tech and communication services and these types of things, which, you know, have, you know, super long duration cash flows and things, and benefit from low interest rates, low inflation, not just their valuations, but their profits and all these things. And the segment of the stock market that is actually, you know, does well in an inflationary environment or is defensive or whatever you want to call it, is such a small portion of the stock market right now that if you own the S&P 500, you're still making a bet on disinflation. And, you know, if you just look at, like I said, tech and communication services are still far and away, you know, the highest weightings, and almost as high as they were at the peak of the dot-com mania. At the same time, energy is only 5% of the S&P 500, and that's less than it was in 2000, 2001, 2002, when oil prices went to $10 a barrel, and when it bottomed out, you know, 20 years ago. It's still below its lowest weighting in history prior to the last few years. And that just tells you that, you know, investors have no exposure to energy, even though it's the best performing sector of this year and last year, don't have any exposure to it. So I think this is, you know, investors might try and remain invested in the S&P 500, but if they do, and inflation does remain elevated, as I believe it will, these sectors are going to continue to suffer.
All right, Jesse, we'll wrap it up here. Look, I think a lot of people do understand that these markets are still in a pretty tough situation and position, but they still haven't fully dropped out of bed. Some sectors have definitely underperformed. The last, let's say, just under a month has been encouraging for investors in a wide range of sectors. But I don't know, there's just this underlying feeling that there's still a lot of weakness to come. And this is going to be nothing more than, I guess, a dead cat bounce. Jesse, thank you as always for your time. Great chatting with you, buddy. We'll chat again next week. I hope you have a great rest of your week.
Thanks, guys. You too.
Al Corland's firm, A.B. Corland & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corland Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.